Good evening. America's most famous whistleblower testifies at the trial of Julian Assange. Is there a doctor known as the uterus collector at an immigration jail in Georgia? And 9 years since Occupy Wall Street, the state of the movement. With these and other stories, I'm Paul DiRienzo with the WBAI News for Wednesday, September 16th, 2020. Hurricane Sally uprooted trees, flooded streets, and cut power to hundreds of thousands of homes and businesses across the Alabama-Florida coast, bringing the threat of more flooding to the U.S. Southeast. Sally made landfall early Wednesday near Gulf Shores, Alabama, as a Category 2 storm, but was downgraded by afternoon to a tropical storm. Pensacola, Florida, suffered up to 5 feet of flooding, and travel was cut by damaged roads and bridges. More than 500,000 homes and businesses across the area were without power. Sally is the 18th named storm in the Atlantic this year. There are currently three other named storms in the Atlantic, making this one of the most active Atlantic hurricane seasons on record. And the top spokesperson for the Department of Health and Human Services is taking a leave of absence days after he promoted dangerous conspiracy theories during a Facebook Live video. Michael Caputo, who is HHS's Assistant Secretary for Public Affairs, charged that scientists at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention don't want America to get well. He also urged Trump supporters to load up on ammunition in preparation for a violent left-wing rebellion when the president wins re-election. He suggested Trump would win, but Biden would refuse to concede. Quote, and when Donald Trump refuses to stand down at the inauguration, the shooting will begin. Caputo said he also referred to the killing of a Trump supporter in Portland by a self-declared anti-fascist as a drill. HHS said Caputo had decided to take a leave of absence to focus on his health and the well-being of his family. And in Bolivia, an opinion poll suggested on Wednesday that Luis Arce, the candidate for the party of Bolivia's former socialist president Evo Morales, could win next month's election in the first round, with opposition to him fragmented among rival parties. Arce is a former economy minister and Morales loyalist. Morales resigned as president on November 10, 2019, calling his removal forced and a coup, but also saying that he wanted to stop the bloodshed. And the United States government's extradition request against WikiLeaks publisher Julian Assange took a pounding today in testimony from a senior journalist, while Pentagon Papers whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg defended Assange for more than 2 hours. Rebecca Miles has been following proceedings at the Old Bailey and files this report.
Wednesday's session began with John Gertz, an award-winning investigative journalist who was working at Der Spiegel from 2007 to 2011. He worked with Julian Assange and the Guardian newspaper on the Afghan war logs, documents leaked by former U.S. Army intelligence analyst Chelsea Manning. Gertz said war logs showed that there were parallel operations underway, as well as regular military action, that showed the U.S. government was involved in assassinations, corruption, and murder, rather like Operation Phoenix during the Vietnam War. Gertz said it was Julian Assange who'd insisted on encryption for communications and ensured that those working on the documents redacted names if they were sensitive. When it came to working on the Afghan war logs, a team from the New York Times went to the White House with the group's concern about publication. The Times, Eric Schmidt, said in an email that the White House wanted redactions and WikiLeaks agreed to redact 15,000 documents. In a strange turn, the prosecutor asked Gertz about Assange's character, quoting Assange's mother, Christine, that her son was fun and witty and extraordinarily unselfish as a father. Gertz replied he didn't have an ability to comment on Assange's fatherhood abilities. Gertz also told the court that the same redaction process happened during the publication of the Iraq War Diary and the U.S. State Department cables, but that communication with the State Department ceased when the department realized they were helping journalists find the most damaging stories by requesting files to be redacted. Giving testimony in the second half of the day was Daniel Ellsberg, famous for the release of the Pentagon Papers, who spoke to the court from California and told the court he was highly cynical of the U.S. government to allege harm caused by the release of WikiLeaks documents, especially as it was the State Department who was responsible for the breakdown in the redaction of names process. One of the counts of the indictment is that Assange allegedly caused harm in the publishing of the names of State Department cables. Prosecutor Lewis started the list of the number of journalists and human rights monitors who were forced to go into hiding as a result of the disclosures. Ellsberg asked whether any of the alleged exposed individuals had been subject to death, violence, harassment or incarceration, as the State Department claims. Rebecca Miles, WBAI Pacifica Radio, New York.
And Daniel Ellsberg, who faced espionage charges for leaking the secret history of the Vietnam War, known as the Pentagon Papers, tells WBAI that if Julian Assange is extradited, the result will be a blow to the First Amendment protection of a free press.
Hypocrisy is normal for humans, and certainly for governments, but this really goes beyond the usual limit for the government to pretend to be concerned about these particular sources in a war which we initiated, which has now led to 37 million refugees. Yes, the publication of their names did understandably cause them anxiety, which he referred to, and a feeling that they were in danger. But there's two things about that. First of all, the publication could have been prevented altogether because both the media and Julian Assange and WikiLeaks tried hard to get the State Department and Defense Department to identify the names they should redact. And the Defense Department, the State Department declined to do that, indicating that they preferred more to preserve these charges, which they're now bringing against them, than to protect these people from publication. It seems as though they didn't regard that danger as too great, or in any case, it turns out not to have been, since not a single one of the hundreds of people that they complain about having been named has in fact been harmed. Their failure to protect them turns out not to, by the government, turns out not to have been as irresponsible as it seemed to be.
What do you think is going to come from this hearing?
Every indication earlier was that the judge and the prosecutor were just going through the motions here and were very hostile to the defense and had made a decision already to go ahead. But the judge did listen intently, I found, to what I was saying today for almost 2 hours. And I think it's really possible, there's reason to hope, that her mind will be changed on this and see that this extradition is very much against the interests of freedom of the press worldwide. And let me say on that, if, as I think they expected to do, if Julian Assange is extradited to the U.S. to face these charges, then no journalist in the world dealing with these issues is safe from life imprisonment in the U.S. This is a very great moment to freedom of the press worldwide, and specifically in the U.S., this extradition would come close to demolishing the First Amendment freedom of the press with respect to what the government chooses to define as national security.
Pentagon Papers whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg speaking with WBAI earlier today. And in more whistleblower coverage, leading congressional Democrats reacted angrily to a whistleblower's claims immigrants held at a detention center in Georgia are undergoing unnecessary hysterectomies from a doctor who's come to be chillingly known as the uterus collector. In a complaint filed Monday, nurse Dawn Wooten alleges the privately run Irwin County Detention Center performed questionable hysterectomies, refused to test detainees for COVID-19, and shredded medical records. She spoke on MSNBC.
I had several detained women on numerous occasions that would come to me and say, "Miss Wooten, I had a hysterectomy. Why?" I had no answers as to why they had those procedures. And one lady walked up to me here this last time around between October of 19 until July the 2nd. And she said, "What is he? Is he the uterus collector? Does he collect uteruses?" And I asked her, "What does she mean?" And she says, "Everybody that I talked to has had a hysterectomy. And you just don't know what to say." I mean, I don't have a answer for why that they would come to me and they would say, is he the uterus collector?
Nurse Dawn Wooten, a national security analyst at the Government Accountability Project, Irvin McCullough, is on Wooten's legal team.
She was a nurse at the Irwin County Detention Center in Ocala, Georgia. It's run by LaSalle Correctional, a private contractor. Immigrants in detention every once in a while have medical problems. And when they have medical problems, they want to go see a doctor, and they deserve medical access. Dawn realized from talking to immigrants, from talking to her coworkers, from trying to help immigrants and providing direct medical care, that a lot of the medical care they were getting was totally inadequate. And in some cases, she heard that immigrants in detention were having unnecessary hysterectomies with very dubious consent. The amount of hysterectomies she heard was having was absolutely a red flag for her.
How is this impacting their ability to treat COVID patients there?
Dawn Wooten made many disclosures to the Department of Homeland Security's Inspector General, their kind of internal watchdog. And a lot of those disclosures were about the total lack of preparedness this facility had for COVID-19. Some of the procedures that the facility was following were not at all in line with CDC guidelines or even ICE's own guidance.
McCullough says COVID-19 cases were mishandled at the Irwin County Detention Center, and little is known about the identity of the doctor accused as the uterus collector.
While working as a nurse there, over the past year, especially since the pandemic began, she began making internal whistleblowing disclosures to her supervisors, to anyone who would listen. Whenever she heard about immigrants in detention just having a terrible time, either not getting the health care they deserved, the medical care that they so desperately needed, in many cases, she disclosed immigrants in detention would be filing requests to go see doctors, go see nurses, to get some health care. Those requests come in paper. There are two forms. One are paper requests, one are electronic requests. Apparently, a lot of the medical staff, according to Dawn, have been shredding the paper requests. And on the electric requests, because you can't shred an electronic request, they just wouldn't see the patient. They wouldn't see the immigrant in detention. They would instead lie and said that they had seen the immigrant in detention.
Why were they carrying out these hysterectomies? It reminds me of the stories you heard of mass sterilizations during the era when science was practicing eugenics.
Why was any of this happening? Dawn doesn't know, and we want some type of investigation into this facility. We want to find out all the facts and find out exactly why this doctor, if what they were doing was some type of discreet abuse, as people have reported, or if this is a more systemic issue, there needs to be oversight and accountability here. There needs to be an investigation here. This is exactly what the Department of Homeland Security and Congress need to investigate.
Do we know what's happening with this doctor, the uterus collector?
We don't know. That's what I'd hope, that anyone who's investigating this, if they find out that these allegations are true, that what Dawn was hearing about and talking to immigrants that they had experienced was true, I'd imagine there'd be a number of sanctions potentially applicable there. And once you have the facts, that's when we start talking about immediate corrective action.
Has there been any retaliation against Nurse Wooten?
There has been. So she was actually demoted when she first started making complaints about this. She's already suffered some backlash, and that's one of the things that we actually want to get to the bottom of, too. The Department of Homeland Security's Inspector General can investigate retaliation against whistleblowers. Ms. Wooten is a whistleblower. She suffered retaliation. She deserves an investigation, and that investigation will show that she's been retaliated against, that her retaliators broke the law. That means that she's entitled to corrective action.
Is this unusual? The Trump administration has had an unusual relationship with whistleblowers.
It certainly has. I worked with whistleblowers from the intelligence community to the State Department to the Department of Justice. Across all of my different jurisdictions, I have seen a pretty big uptick in whistleblowing. And that's a good thing, that there are people who are willing to stand up and speak out when they see something that's wrong. But it means there's been a lot more wrongdoing for people to speak out about.
Irvin McCullough is a national security analyst at the Government Accountability Project and part of whistleblower Dawn Wooten's legal team. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi released a statement reading in part, "If true, the appalling conditions described in the whistleblower complaint, including allegations of mass hysterectomies being performed on vulnerable immigrant women, are a staggering abuse of human rights." Pelosi says she's calling for an immediate investigation. And you're listening to the news on WBAI New York. I'm Paul DiRienzo. Displaced residents in Southern Oregon and Northern California are starting to get good news. The Oregon State Fire Marshal's Office reported that the urban fire just outside of Medford, Oregon, is now 100% contained as of Wednesday afternoon. Near Pasadena, California, firefighters reported Wednesday that they have prevented a wildfire from damaging the Mount Wilson Observatory, which played a pivotal role in early 20th century astronomy. Air quality is still bad as smoke begins to reach the East Coast and even Europe. While President Trump is blamed for poor forest management, Jack Baldwin of the environmental group Extinction Rebellion says that's only part of the story.
The vegetation is drier so that the moisture in the vegetation evaporates more quickly and starts to burn more rapidly, more extensively. We've seen larger fires. We've seen quicker fires than ever in the history of that whole region. The winds are higher, which means that the fires are extending over a larger area. This will continue. It will not get better. It will get worse year by year because climate change is getting worse year by year. Apparently, it's a surprise to President Trump because he's blaming it on the leaves on the forest floor. It's something that scientists have known would happen, but they may not have predicted how bad it would be and how rapidly things would get worse.
The forest management argument that the president has come up with, that's not entirely untrue.
No, it's not entirely untrue, but what it comes to is that there needs to be more money to clear the forests, to make them less flammable, to make them less dangerous. You need funds not only to fight fires, but to preserve the forest themselves and the ecosystems of that forest. The money for that from the federal government and from state governments have not been forthcoming, and that should be prioritized.
Is it reversible or is this the new normal?
It's the new normal unless we find the political will to reverse it. Extinction Rebellion's two first demands are tell the truth and act now. The media is not telling the truth because they're in a he said type of situation where one person says one thing, scientists say one thing, and science deniers say another thing, and they're given equal weight. Act now is a second demand, which means that you can't only have media and politicians tell the truth. You have to act on it. A good example is the New York City Council declared a climate emergency, which was one of our Extinction Rebellion's goals and other climate group goals in New York. But they so far haven't acted on that resolution to declare a climate emergency a year after they have declared it.
But what about the upper middle class? How do you convince them? Because they're the ones who have the money to create an opposition.
There are a lot of people in the middle class and upper middle class who are politically at least centrist or left of center, who are willing to concede that there is such a thing as climate change. And the ultimate hostages are the young people, the children who are alive now and the children who will be alive in the next generation. And that is their investment. That is what they are invested in. And we have to show people from all classes that they have to invest in the future and there has to be shared sacrifices.
Jack Baldwin of the environmental group Extinction Rebellion. And tomorrow marks 9 years since Occupy Wall Street, an ad hoc group of activists, took over Zuccotti Park in Lower Manhattan to bring their message of social change and economic equality to the world. Their call that we are the 99% as opposed to the 1% who own most of the world has become a meme for activists to this day. One of the organizers of Occupy Wall Street is Rutgers University history professor Mark Bray, who is also author of Antifa, the Anti-Fascist Handbook, exploring the history of anti-fascist movements since the 1920s and their contemporary resurgence. He says inequality has always given rise to conflict.
One of the most significant things that's changed from 2011 to the present is the normalcy in American society of protest. Because I was one of the organizers of Occupy back in 2011 in New York. And there was a sense, I think, for a lot of people that protest was something exceptional. maybe still stuck in the idealism of the 60s. And Occupy Wall Street played a big role in smashing that misconception, normalizing protest, and normalizing a kind of decentralized, leaderless, do-it-yourself form of protest that has had an influence on many of the movements we've seen over this really dynamic decade of protests.
What got people to become more protest-oriented?
Normalizing protest as a regular phenomenon, as something that's not strange, and the development of more of a genuine left and a genuine working class movement in the U.S. has kind of created a foundation from which people can organize, fight for 15, and all sorts of different campaigns.
All the things that were done to sort of hold down protests created their opposite effect.
Also, distance from the end of the Cold War is important because still in the 90s, the notion that anything that smacked of socialism or communism was evil, that notion has faded away. And we can see in polling that younger generations are more sympathetic to things that are labeled as socialism.
Let's talk about Antifa. That's your book. Is that related to Occupy or is it something totally new?
Antifa's willingness to physically confront the far right is significantly different from Occupy's general focus on nonviolent forms of resistance. Anti-fascism in its long history has been a movement that focuses on shutting down the ability of the far right to normalize itself in our communities, to express its message, especially after World War II and in recent decades. Anti-fascists have basically made the argument that if you don't want another repeat of something like the Third Reich, you treat every far-right group as if they could be the seeds of a genocidal regime, and sometimes that requires physically shutting them down before they can even get going. And that's very different from simply a message through a protest. It has a very, this anti-fascist opposition to the far-right has a very definitive goal of preventing the far-right from being able to mobilize.
In the last 9 years, sure, we've seen the growth of a much more determined right-wing that didn't exist even 9 years ago.
Anti-racist action, which was a kind of predecessor to the Antifa we see in the U.S. today, was very big in the 90s and had a lot of chapters and groups around the country, but it didn't get the same kind of public media recognition. But then the profile of that organizing declined into the 2000s and reignited with the development of the alt-right and the Trump campaign.
Is this a creation of just people, enthusiasts on both sides, or is this a different sort of conflict than we've seen?
It's a reflection of significant changes in the fabric of this country, changes around values that you can see through, you know, feminist and Me Too movements, Black Lives Matter, queer and trans liberation struggles. And the far right feels under attack insofar as its values are being eaten away. That unfortunately often manifests itself violently, and Antifa and other kind of anti-fascist and anti-racist have mobilized to really try and push back and make sure that that far-right violent menace doesn't harm as many people as it would.
What do you see as the future of Antifa?
Beyond whether Trump wins or loses, what I'm interested in seeing is what the future of Trumpism will look like, whether Republicans and other far-right figures will take up his example and try and make that a mainstay of American politics. Whether or not that happens, though, the kind of global shifts in the values and the demographics of our country, the kind of myth of a Christian white America is going away. And so that is going to spur a violent backlash, regardless of who's in office, and will necessitate a kind of anti-fascist response. And so in that sense, I don't think the story is over or limited to just a question of whether Trump wins or not. Although, of course, he has played a pivotal role in igniting this far right resurgence and emboldening a lot of these figures, and it certainly would be bad if he won again.
Mark Bray is author of Antifa, the Anti-Fascist Handbook. And tomorrow, veterans of Occupy Wall Street will be meeting at Zuccotti Park at 11 a.m. as they do every year. Organizer Marnie Halassa.
Every year, I try to organize a speak out and press conference to show the significance of Occupy and how Occupy influences the activism that many activists do today. Occupy took income inequality into the national conversation, but what it also did is provide this protest infrastructure for this movement to come into fruition. You see the influence of Occupy in other movements like workers organizing, the fight for 15, climate activism, and today the spirit of Occupy is really present in the many fights you see against gentrification. Occupy had a really significant influence. I still think it continues today.
The Occupy didn't have any demands, did not transition into being the type of movement the Tea Party began, which was the counter movement at the time.
Correct. Sometimes people say that that's sort of a criticism of Occupy. the real sort of like strength of Occupy is it just created this protest infrastructure. So even now you see a lot of other movements use the Occupy protest infrastructure. Even today, like, you know, let's just take Occupy City Hall. Okay, so that was a movement to defund and demilitarize the police, defunding the police by $1 billion in order to transform the police into a public safety model. Occupy City Hall was very similar to Occupy Wall Street. It had a library. It had food for people. It had artists and painters, dancers sort of doing the craft. People were almost bartering. It became a place for people down and out to gather, get something to eat, and even have a discussion. So Occupy City Hall was very similar to Occupy Wall Street. When I went down there, I thought it was a beautiful thing. I thought, like, everybody's getting along. Everybody's talking about ideas. It really was for, like, this very, very important cause, which was to defund and demilitarize the police and defund the police by $1 billion and take that money and put it into communities of color, which is, like, so very needed. Mm-hmm. In terms of Black Lives Matter, let's say somebody gets, unfortunately, killed by the police. Everybody knows to go to Union Square. People already know how to organize. That's really the legacy of Occupy Wall Street. There's going to be a speak out and press conference on the steps of Zuccotti Park at 11 a.m. We do this every year. And anybody that wants to come down and just talk about the activism that you're working on and how Occupy influenced you, we'd love to have everybody come down and just speak like 2, 3, 4 minutes. I've got a bullhorn. I got my signage, you know, just to make it an event. But it's always like a wonderful reunion. It's wonderful to see everybody. And then everybody can kind of catch up on what they've been doing. We have a great time.
Organizer Marnie Halassa. And that's the news for Wednesday, September 16th, 2020. The news was produced with Rebecca Miles and Linda Perry. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. From New York City, for the WBAI News, I'm Paul DiRienzo. Thanks for listening.